Hey, John.
Hey, Nick.
What's our topic today?
Five pieces of art that aren't what you think they are.
Faster.
Five pieces of art that aren't what you think they are.
Faster.
Five pieces of art that aren't what you think they are.
Faster.
Five pieces of art that aren't art and art.
And this is Stranger Still. Welcome to Stranger Still,
a podcast where we learn about art.
I'm Nick Wood.
I'm John Began.
Wait, you changed our tagline and I almost didn't notice.
I was gonna make it that's our new tagline until the next episode.
Okay, and then you'll have a new one by then?
I'm working on it.
Am I having to change like the website and everything?
Just a couple times.
Okay, so July is a very special month for us and everyone on the Flying Machine Network because we are doing a Patreon drive.
And every one of the yous. Listenings.
And every one of the yous listening, because this is the perfect time if you thought, hey, maybe I listen to Stranger Still and maybe I should check out some of the other sister podcasts out there on the Flying Machine Network, or maybe I should kick a few bucks their way to their Patreon. And to give you a little tasty taste of what some of those other shows are like, we're going to be having guests on all month long.
That's right. Appetizers are free. Free samples.
Yeah.
You just get a little taste of a guest.
Some hors d'oeuvres.
Keep moving. One guest per episode.
Yeah, we don't want to cram more than one person.
And we're trying to make money here.
And our guest this week has been patiently on the sidelines waiting for us to just shut up. And we have with us one of the hosts of Short, Colorful, and Loud.
One of the best letters of the alphabet.
L.
Hi, guys.
It took me way too long to figure out what the hell you're talking about, John.
I watched a lot of Sesame Street growing up.
So, Elle, you are the host of Short, Short, Colorful, and Loud. Can you tell us a little bit about that podcast?
It's a podcast about kids' movies made for grown-ups by grown-ups. It's my friend Zach and I. We are both legal adults who enjoy kids' movies, and we watch them and we talk about them, particularly ones that you maybe forgot about.
Yes.
That's wonderful. I've also been a legal adult. Since I was 18.
That's true. You have been legal since you were 18. I always think it's funny because, just to part the veil a little bit, whenever I'm listening to your podcast, I always talk or hear you guys talking about like, oh, I saw this one when I was in college. And I personally, me and my wife always went to go see animated movies when we were legally adults. And I was like, God, we're such losers. And then I hear other people went to go see animated movies when they were full grown adults. And I'm like, okay, thank God I'm not alone in this.
You felt guilty about enjoying the art of film?
Yeah, because I'm surrounded like by parents and children.
Yeah.
This is before we had kids. And I'm like, oh, okay, I guess I'm the only adult.
I saw Tangled in theaters by myself when I was a freshman in college.
More power to you. I didn't even start going to see movies by myself until like last year.
Oh,
you guys are both doing
best.
It wrong. I'm telling you. Kids have the best entertainment. That's why I go and hang out at daycares by myself, too. I
don't.
They got free juice.
Now you're on the
Do you grow your mustache
list.
In first?
Yeah.
Just a little Wear bit. A hoodie, why gloves.
So if people have looked at our the title of this episode and are now wondering why we have someone who makes a podcast about children's movies is here to talk about art, why are we talking about art, Elle?
Because it's actually what I have a degree in. I'm a degreed art historian, I guess, if that's what you can call it. But I studied art history and crit in college, and I like it a lot, and I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, and I assume every time you go to a family gathering, someone's like, so what are you doing with your art history degree?
Yeah, and the answer, I just like to say different things with it. Like, I tell them about where I've put it in my house. Sometimes it's my living room. Sometimes I put it in my kitchen, you know.
That's a good solution.
Decorating.
I was going to say, now you can tell them I went on a podcast and talked about art history.
Yeah, crit art history. She rolled a 20, Nick.
Yeah.
Don't you forget
Nat
that part.
20. So we've got, as John alluded to in our opening, we've got five pieces of art or areas of art that aren't what you think they are. And you've brought some little pieces of art to us to examine and dissect like a frog in high school. Is that right?
Yeah. You guys brought scalpels, right?
Are you trying to upset me?
I am trying to upset
We actually,
you.
Hey, we
hey,
have...
frogs.
What's that?
We have this actual art and we're going to cut it open right now.
Yeah, we stole the Mona Lisa. We're going to rip
and
it open.
We're looking at a spooky skeleton
inside.
Underneath it.
Yeah. So what better place to start than probably the most famous work of art ever?
Mm-hmm. The Mona Lisa.
I was trying to think of a really quick joke and I couldn't.
A quick joke? You passed over the joke already.
What is it?
You should have said st-art.
We should.
What better place to st-art
than the art?
Right.
The Mona Lisa.
The Mona Lisa.
The Mona Lisa.
Go ahead.
Is a picture of a smile. The first smile captured on film. Right. Am I understanding my art history correctly?
Because they invented the camera during the Renaissance.
Right.
Leonardo da Vinci made it.
400 years old, right?
Everything looked really... They only had one filter. It was paint.
Yeah. They didn't have Instagram yet.
They used eggs, but, you know, like, whatever. That's a tempera paint joke, guys.
Okay.
That's why the Last Supper's falling apart.
Some art nerd out there is like, yes! Yes! No, but seriously, the Mona Lisa was painted by the best Ninja Turtle. Leonardo DiCaprio.
Wonderful. What color was he?
Purple? Have I alienated enough people?
I've gone so long without hearing that joke.
Okay. I take it back.
What color was Leonardo?
Leonardo? He's the blue one.
Okay. Well, that's why
it's my favorite.
That's why I thought purple.
What's your favorite Ninja Turtle?
Raphael.
What? Elle, what's yours?
I like Donatello as an artist. He's interesting.
Yeah. So, but we're not talking about that. We are talking about real art, real Renaissance art, and that is the Mona Lisa. Can you tell us a little bit about this painting?
The Mona Lisa it's probably the world's most famous painting, and because of that, mm-hmm. it often gets regarded as the world's best painting. Mm-hmm. And, like, it's not even Leonardo da Vinci's best painting, to be honest.
So I've always heard these stories of, they have it up in, do they have it in the Louvre?
Le Louvre, where is it hanging? Oui.
The Louvre.
Oui, en Paris.
Oh, geez. Mm. We're getting farther and farther away from my comfort zone.
Yeah, it's in the Louvre.
So I often hear stories of people that, like, go to the Louvre just to see the Mona Lisa, and they show up and they're like, that thing is tiny.
It is.
And they're, like, really disappointed because it's, like, what, 20 inches by, like, 30 inches or something.
And it's on a wall by itself.
Yeah.
Like, it's in this huge high-ceilinged room. I didn't go see it because the line was too long when I was there, but there was a line, and it's this huge wall with this...
Can you imagine?
Tiny, yeah. Frankly, hey, unremarkable painting.
It's not his fault. This is just the first single on his album mm-hmm. of paintings.
So you know? I, going into this episode, I knew that you would be tearing these apart. So I tried to find reasons why people find these works of art so remarkable. And from what I understand, and I am no art expert by any means, I just make dumb cartoon drawings. The biggest things were that it was like it popularized the three-quarter portrait, which is like when you slightly tilt from the incoming camera angle, right?
And, like Super Mario RPG.
Elle is not satisfied with my answer.
Oh, no, I'll wait.
I also heard it told that the composition was much different than what they were used to. It was a heavy bottom and drew your focus toward the top where the smile is. Mm-hmm. The painting techniques with all of the blending and stuff were very good for the time. The hands were very realistic because of Da Vinci's study of the human body. I think Elle just put her hands on her hips. And I learned that the eyebrows were probably removed when the painting was being cleaned. That has nothing to do with why the piece of art is important. But I did learn that.
Mm-hmm. It's because they already had all the t-shirts made at the same time as the painting.
Oh, yeah.
And they needed a way to sell them.
Yeah, I understand that. But I also, there's a story that he traveled around with the painting to show off his talents, and I have no idea if that's true or not, but that might be why it's so popular and regarded as maybe his best work in the public eye. So tell me why I'm wrong, Elle.
So none of what you said is wrong, really. It's just more that it's not the first and it didn't really popularize any of that. Mm-hmm. So we'll start with the three-quarter pose. That's sort of like the most flattering way to photograph or like depict anybody in like a three-quarter
that's where
pose.
You get your good side, yeah.
Yeah. He actually had three other paintings of individual women, not totally dissimilar from the Mona Lisa. Mm-hmm. That use that pose. Some of them more interesting than others. There's the portrait of Cecilia Gallerani, or Woman with an Ermine. You've probably seen it. If you Google that, you'll be like, oh, this painting, which is going to be a theme throughout this episode.
Yeah, what was that painting called again?
Woman with an Ermine.
What is she holding?
It's an ermine.
Oh, God, you'd think that I would know that. All right. Yeah, I like this one. This is a good painting.
So she's a little bit more interesting because she's in that three-quarter pose, but she's actually looking at something sort of off-camera, which was kind mm-hmm. of novel for the late 1400s when this was painted. It's actually painted in 1489
back then.
Well, off-camera is a phrase.
I know.
She's looking off-canvas at something, and it sort mm-hmm. of tells a little bit more of a story than your average portrait at the time would. leading up to this, most people were painted either directly face on, like facing the viewer or staring straight ahead, or they were painted in full profile. Mm-hmm. And Leonardo sort of took that to the next level by painting people in three quarters pose, which Mona Lisa obviously is. But you also have these paintings like this one, and the other one is La Belle Ferronnière, where they're looking off camera, and it kind of implies that there's a world outside of the painting, mm-hmm. which is pretty novel for the time.
So, this is just the premium version of the Mona Lisa.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I know. Like, I don't know if it's because the Mona Lisa has been poorly cleaned from what I've learned, but the quality on this one is, like, it's a lot sharper, and honestly, it does look more better good. More better
good. More better good, for sure, yeah.
And obviously, I think these paintings are better, but I think there's a lot of really interesting reasons as to why we actually look at the Mona Lisa instead of these. And in that sense, the Mona Lisa is the most famous painting because it's the most famous painting, which is a weird concept. But it ended up in the Louvre, which meant that there was a lot more exposure for it early on, particularly in the 19th century when people were starting to write about how great Leonardo da Vinci was.
Yeah.
Freud wrote a lot about him, and that made him really popular. And this was just a...
So he wrote about the smile, right?
He wrote about Leonardo da Vinci in general, and it's not G-rated, so we won't get into it.
Now I'm very curious. Was he, like, writing fan fiction or something?
I don't know if you want to cut this, but there's a lot of theories that Leonardo da Vinci was a repressed homosexual and that you could find it in all of his art. Freud was a crackpot who did a lot of cocaine.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of people realize how bad Freud was.
Did we shred him already? Didn't we do an episode?
I don't think we did. No.
Can we do something devoted to just shredding him to shreds?
I think we should.
Please do. I'm going to talk about his buddy Young later, who's awesome.
All right.
We already talked about the Ninja Turtles. Now we need some shredder.
Good job, John.
Thanks.
I'm proud of you.
So, I work on that for 30 minutes.
So like I said, it ended up in the Louvre. It was written about a lot. And in the 19th century, you had a lot of various famous people going and writing about the Mona Lisa. And it started to sort of be revered in the same way that we started revering Leonardo da Vinci himself. Even though upon closer examination, most of his inventions were kind of crackpot, half-baked ideas. He sort of started being regarded as like almost the father of modernity, which isn't totally
true. That's a big
word.
What's modernity?
Modern times.
Oh,
this is actually—I swear,
I knew
this
that.
Is. Yeah, I knew that too. I'm only, so sorry.
I'm only smart
Nick is—he's
half the time.
Yeah, I apologize on his behalf.
Thanks,
in all modernity,
I appreciate it.
But the Mona Lisa's big marquee moment actually came in 1911 when it was stolen from the Louvre by a guy named Perugia who wanted to return it to its native Italy. Like you said, Leonardo.
So he's like Indiana Jones.
He was a pierogi-based villain.
Yeah, he was actually a large pierogi. It's very strange.
Perugiana Jones. Anyway, what?
It belongs out of a museum.
That's I didn't mean to interrupt you. What do you got?
Nick, you were actually totally right. Leonardo da Vinci did travel with the Mona Lisa. It's one of the only paintings he brought from when he left Florence and went to France. The way that it actually ended up in the Louvre is he died in France. And King Francis I was like, this looks like my painting now.
This is mine.
Yeah, pretty much.
Disney's.
And so it got stolen in 1911. And somehow this just became like the blockbuster of the year. I guess they didn't really have movies yet. So
yeah, they didn't have much else going on.
People went to the Louvre to look at the empty space where it had been on the wall.
Wow, can you imagine?
Pablo Picasso was arrested as a suspect for the theft.
Really?
Yeah. And they found it not that long later, and it was returned. And then it went on a world tour. Uh-huh. And from there, it just kind of became this like symbol and icon of fine art in a way that no other painting really had achieved. It was like, you know how Jaws is the first blockbuster?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Mona Lisa, through drama, became the first blockbuster painting.
Yeah, that's nuts. Mostly because people were so bored back then.
Yeah, they didn't have TV, so they were going to go look at
the
empty space.
Paintings.
They literally looked at an empty space at a wall because they had nothing better to do.
But I think a lot about those other paintings that I mentioned, particularly Woman with an Ermine, because I think it's really beautiful. And I always wonder, like, why wasn't this the painting that people fixated on? And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that even now, aside from the Mona Lisa and the Last Supper, there are people who don't think a vast majority of work that we say is Leonardo da Vinci's work is actually his. He,
like, scholarly or just like people that's not Leonardo.
Like, if you look at a list of his paintings, a lot of them will say this is universally accepted as a Leonardo da Vinci painting. This is generally accepted as a Leonardo da Vinci painting.
I'm looking.
It has a ferret-like
so
creature in it. Yeah. So I don't get why it's not the most popular.
Yeah. Who
That's
doesn't
my
love
question.
Ferrets?
Also, there are so many people throughout the years who just decided they were going to paint right over these paintings themselves.
So they're just, like, lost forever?
Yeah, well, like, Woman with an Ermine, the black background that was added in the 1700s because somebody decided it would look better that way.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
What a bunch of idiots.
It happens all the time.
Oh, my God.
They turned on portrait mode.
Yeah, blurred out the background, I guess.
Literally, that happens more often in art than you think. At some point in, like, the 1700s, somebody thought they knew better and decided to just paint right over it. Wow. Or go and fix something.
Now people are doing that at thrift stores and adding R2-D2 into the forest of...
Well, I was thinking, it reminds me of, like...
folk art?
Well, just how, like, back in the day, even the 60s, we just have such a mind for preserving history. Like, back in the 60s...
Just go on.
I got
like
it,
back John. Back in the 60s, like, a bunch of the original Doctor Who episodes were lost because they just didn't care. So they just, like, kept them in a room, and then they all burned up, and they're like, okay.
I thought they taped over them.
I believe some of them were taped over, but a lot of them, since it was on celluloid, burned up. And then I was talking to Ryan from Divisive Issues the other day, and he said that a bunch of the original comics from, like, the 40s are no longer around because people just threw them away or donated the paper to the army and stuff because people just didn't care. They didn't know that it was going to be a historical landmark. So it's just like that. People just, they're like, oh, it's a picture of a lady. No one's going to care about this. I'll just add a little black here, and it'd be great, right?
This is a perfect segue into my second piece of art.
All right, let's go for it. What do you got?
Most ancient Greek sculptures are not actually ancient Greek sculptures.
What does that mean?
Whoa. So, most ancient Greek sculptures were actually done in bronze. And, you know, this is weird, but back in the day, bronze was actually really hard to come by. So, if you were...
What's bronze made out of?
No, I actually don't know. I used to know that.
I know, me too.
It's one of the things I dumped.
Chemistry. Anyway, someone out there is yelling at us right now. I'll look this up. You keep talking. It is made out of copper. It's a copper alloy with manganese, nickel, and zinc.
And it has lots of other uses, like weapons and door hinges and jewelry. So if you're, say, you know, someone who's maybe middle class in the Roman Empire and you find this hunk of bronze while you're invading Greece to take it in as part of the Roman Empire... You're maybe not going to think to yourself, that's a beautiful statue that people want to look at in 2.5 millennia. You're going to think to yourself, that looks like a lot of swords. So.
I thought you were going to say a very nice necklace.
No, a lot of swords.
Yeah.
Maybe some shields, boot buckles. So when we look at Greek sculptures, a vast majority of what we know about Greek sculpture actually comes from later Roman copies. During the later part of the Roman Empire, they got really, really into Greek art, and they basically started mass-producing copies. You would find an ancient Greek bronze statue, and you would say, man, this is such a cool statue, I'd like my own. So they'd take a bunch of casts of it, and then they'd turn it into either marble or maybe, like, another material. They'd do it either to scale, like life-size, or they'd do a smaller version.
Wow. So, like, when you see, I don't know, like, Hippocrates or something, it's in a marble sculpture, it's probably a recreation of that.
We have some originals.
But not many?
Yeah. So, marble is easier to not melt down and turn into other things, because, you know, nobody really wants a marble sword. So, those are really that have been brought to us. And some of the most, like, iconic pieces of ancient Greek art are actually later Roman copies. So,
oh, I'm so excited for this. You're going to shatter my world here.
So Discobolus, the discus thrower, a lot of people can picture him.
Yeah.
The original's by Myron. It's probably 460 to 450 BCE, but everything we have left is a Roman copy in marble. There's a couple bronze versions, but they're not the one from that tier or that era. Aphrodite of Cnidos by Praxiteles. He's a pretty famous one. That's probably from the 4th century BCE. All we have left are Roman copies in marble. And finally, the Apollo Belvedere, which is, he's mostly naked except for his cloak, and he's got a funny hat on, and he's extending his arm out.
Oh, I know this one. Yeah.
He's probably by Leocares, who I'm probably butchering that name. He was probably originally made in 350 BCE, but the only thing we have is a Roman copy. And it doesn't seem like it should be that big of a deal because, you know, they're copying it. But the Romans had slightly different artistic tastes than the ancient Greeks did. And we're talking about like a 500 to 700 year difference in when these things were made. So a lot of what we know about ancient Greek art, for a long time, we didn't really differentiate it from Roman, but some of it might not be true because these were copies. We don't know what the original looked like. We don't know how much they embellished.
Yeah, so what did they prefer? Like, what were their differences?
It's hard to say.
Like six packs more, or
if you heard my heavy sigh, it's just a bummer because I know how hard ancient Greeks work to get like followers, and if you're not going to credit your work and you're just going to steal memes,
yeah,
it's a brutal culture.
Hey, they put credit in the bio.
Yeah,
they put credit in the bio.
At least tag back.
We actually don't really know what a lot of the major differences are, and we know a little bit about their technique of copying, which is why we can trust these Roman copies as faithful to the original, but there's always that little bit of doubt. And there was also the fact that the Romans were a lot more prudish than the Greeks were.
Oh.
So the Greeks were really into being naked. That was something that they really, really liked. They really felt like the naked male body was the epitome of beauty.
Yeah.
And the Romans are the ones who invented that thing where you'll see the leaf over somebody's private area. Yeah. Because they were less comfortable with that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. So so I imagine they just made like the genitalia smaller then. And the Greeks were probably like, here's some big cojones.
Yeah, the Greeks were, they had a lot of festivals about big cojones.
Yeah. Well, the Olympics, everyone was just naked the whole time.
Yeah. And wrestling naked, running naked.
Yeah. Can you imagine?
No.
Yeah.
There's a really famous... And I think it's an original ancient Greek statue, but it's like the scraper, and it's this guy who's like naked and cleaning himself, and it's supposed to be like a young Olympiad cleaning himself because they cleaned themselves with salt and olive oil back then. They'd like rub it all over, and then they would like scrape it
back
off themselves.
You guys must not be Italian.
You still do that?
Extra virgin.
Every time I call John on the weekends.
That sounds so expensive.
Every time I call John on the weekends, I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm just bathing in a tub of olive oil, rubbing salt on myself.
Yeah, just rubbing a salt and olive oil scrub and then scraping it off out in the yard, as you do. It's heroic, according to the ancient Greeks.
It sounds like the Romans were just making impressions of the Greek work. Am I right?
So would you say the Romans were the first impressionists?
Oh.
Because you'd be wrong.
Oh, okay.
It's a 19th century movement, thank you.
Wow, you got dunked on.
Here's the thing that I learned about the Impressionist era is that two artists whose names I know is Claude Monet and someone else, like, crafted the style of Impressionism over 2 months of work, just trying to figure out how to make this art movement. And for those that don't know what the Impressionist movement is...
Well, let me just explain to you what an Impressionist, Nicholas. The top 1% of impressions
are usually
bad.
Bernie Sanders. Elle, can you explain to our audience what a visual medium is through your words?
All right, buckle up, guys.
I'm
about to get meta.
Ready.
My cerebral cortex is flexing.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
I'm going to lay a little groundwork for our next two topics.
Okay.
We invented the photograph in the mid-19th century. And after that, art kind of broke. What was the point of naturalistic photorealistic painting if you could just take a picture? Well, first we got the Impressionists, who decided, we don't need to make it look 3D. We don't need to paint anything in specific. Mm-hmm. We're just going to paint modern life. We're going to go out. We're going to bring our easel. We're going to paint this. I'm going to paint, like, Monet was just like, I'm going to paint Rouen at sunset. It's going to take 15 minutes. It didn't actually take 15 minutes, though. They kind of got this rep for being spontaneous. Like, they were just going out and throwing whatever impression they got of the situation onto the canvas, and they did finish their paintings a whole lot more quickly than, say, like, David or Delacroix were. Those are historical painters from earlier in the century. But this idea that they did their paintings, like, so quickly actually fell apart once we got to the 20th century, and in 1991, a collection of art historians, David Bomford, John Leighton, Joe Kirby, and Ashok Roy, went to the National Gallery in London and actually did a bunch of X-ray and infrared imaging of a couple of famous paintings. And they found that based on the way that the paint was arranged on the canvas and the sort of borders between the paint... Mm-hmm. There was, like, significant drying between applications of paints, so they actually probably spent a little bit more time on it than we thought they did. it's less of a spontaneous, artistic, like whimsical thing than we really thought it was.
And so correct me if I'm wrong, but I guess the reason people thought it was spontaneous is because the paintings are, they're a lot of like short brush strokes. So it looks like just like a bunch of dots, like halftone printing on a comic book or something like that, but much bigger than that, obviously. But
halftone comes from this.
Yeah.
That's where we got the idea.
Right. And a lot of the paintings are, I heard it described as if you just caught a glance of something. That's kind of the feel that a lot of these went for. Like you didn't have time to focus in on whatever was going on. You just got a glance at it. So a lot of them look kind of, I don't want to say simple, but they look like you said, someone just took their easel out to the street and started putting dots on a canvas.
And they did do that to some extent. Like they did paint en plein air is what we call it, like out in the open air. And you were talking about how the paintings look. The term we use in the Art Historical Society to describe that type of stroke is a painterly brushstroke.
Painterly brushstroke.
Like a painter would do, which is just such a silly term.
So redundant to me.
Yeah, painterly brushstrokes.
This painter used painterly brushstrokes.
I only painterly use hairbrush strokes. Or toothbrush strokes.
What?
Those are the only kind of brushes I could think of.
Oh,
But it was an art style much more about capturing the way that the light hits something rather than necessarily telling a story, which is what a lot of mainstream art had done up until that point.
Oh, yeah. That's my favorite thing of looking at these is like the light play that they have on here.
Yeah.
They play with like light sources and light falling through leaves and stuff and different light sources, reflections of light, all kinds of stuff. It's like so simple, but it's maybe one of my favorite styles of art.
Yeah.
Except for like surrealism, but that's like apples and oranges.
I'm going to give you guys my worst, most unpopular art opinion.
Yes.
Claude Monet is a hack and Seurat was all we needed. He's the one who did pointillism. And Edward Manet, or Monet, almost spelled the same as Monet, actually invented Impressionism. But
oh, but Claude Monet gets all of the credit.
Yeah, and Monet and Manet actually fought because Monet accused Manet of copying his signature, which is ridiculous because their last names are one letter off from each other.
Yeah, that's like
Both SoundCloud links first, though. So
right, he linked them in bio.
That's not how SoundCloud works.
So the other thing that I know. So the other thing that I kind of got from researching Impressionism is that a lot of the paintings from the time, like you said, they were historical, they were meant to tell a story, or they were portraits, or they were religious paintings or something like that. And a lot of these were, like, at the time, landscapes were for scrubs, for people, like, they were the lesser art at the time. And a lot of Impressionist art was landscapes and, like, city modern life.
The city modern life is actually the really, like, revolutionary thing that happens in the mid-19th century. Mm-hmm. I mentioned Edouard Manet. He's sort of called the father of modern art sometimes, even though he totally didn't want to be. He painted this painting called Déjeuner sur l'herbe, or The Lunch in the Grass, which has two sort of modern well-to-do gentlemen with a naked woman who's very obviously just a prostitute.
Oh, I've seen this one. Here, yeah. I'll show John.
And it's a big deal because normally men were always painting naked women. That's why a lot of people became painters, so they could look at naked women. That's a true thing, but they would always make them a goddess. Like, this is Venus, but actually it's just Ashley. Like, but he didn't hide the fact that this was just Ashley, although actually we do know who that woman is. Her name was Victorine Mérant. She was also a painter. But it was kind of like this weird confluence of, they changed the way that they were painting. They would go out in the open air. They wouldn't be in the studio. They used these like thick, visible brushstrokes. And they also changed the subject. They were painting everyday people as they were going about their lives. I mean, not everyday people. Most of them were ridiculously wealthy.
Mm-hmm. But it wasn't a portrait.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just to recap, the thick brushes that they're doing for the naked people, that's T-H-I-C-C.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was the original thick.
How are you going to paint a thick lady without thick brushstrokes?
That's right. Very true. It's very true.
And Victorine Mérant, she was thick.
Yeah.
But the point that I was making here was just that there's an idea that Impressionism was this super spontaneous, quickly achieved thing. And actually, it was a lot more methodical. Yeah, the artists were a lot crafted. More methodical in their approach to it than I think we give them credit for. And it was kind of cool that X-ray and infrared analysis is actually what sort of revealed that to us.
Yeah.
Yeah. The technology. One that I think was the most interesting was Renoir, Auguste Renoir, who's actually, I won't get into it. He painted this painting called
to.
I just think he's he's a hack too. Anyways.
That's important. That's what we're here for.
Yeah.
My bad art opinions.
No.
You're great.
Talk smack.
Bad art opinions.
Yeah.
I could talk smack about the Impressionists. Don't get me started. They're basically the Marvel Cinematic Universe of the art world.
Oh.
Yeah. They're fun and they sell tickets, but they're making your brain smooth.
Oh. Wow. Them's fighting words.
Yeah. I was kidding. That's way too far. This is, you're going to get, please direct your emails to Elle. Oh my God.
I love the Marvel Cinematic Universe for what it's worth.
Yeah.
No, you're totally right.
Yeah.
The other thing I was going to say about Impressionism, it was kind of meant to go against popular conventions at the time, right?
Yeah, it started off pretty revolutionary. People were working as hard as they could to achieve naturalism, which is the word we use when you take a 2D surface like a canvas or a piece of wood or a wall and try to make it look like a three-dimensional space, mm-hmm. which is something they started sort of working on in the Renaissance, and they'd sort of all but perfected in the mid-19th century. You had, like, almost photorealistic paintings of people. And then, like I said, the photograph was invented. I think the daguerreotype is, like, 1839, I want to say. That's our first silver plate photos.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like people... It was kind of like art broke and then reformed and became something way more interesting.
They had to prove that it was still relevant, right?
And one of the ways that they did that, and it's sort of this like revolution we talk about in art history, where we started treating the canvas like a two-dimensional thing rather than pretending it was three-dimensional. And then eventually, so we start with Impressionism and things are less photorealistic, and then we get into Cubism. And then in the mid-20th century, a weird thing happened.
Well, just let me express myself for a second.
Can you give me an abstract first?
That's
a fancy word for a summary. Sorry.
That one I do know. I have to express my feelings on paint and paintings, and I don't really know how to do that. And all I have here is this canvas. What can I do with this? What do you think?
What's your favorite color?
Purple.
Does it make you feel things?
It makes me feel things.
Cool. You could indulge in some abstract expressionism.
Tell me more, Elle.
Well, there's sort of a common... Let me tell you about when you've experienced abstract expressionism. Have you ever walked through a museum and looked at a painting and thought, ugh, Rory could do that?
All the time. I did that last summer.
Well, you're wrong.
I know.
She can't?
You're so wrong.
Are you having
I mean,
Rory?
She could, but that's not the point.
Okay.
First of all, what I always tell people when they say that is, yeah, you could, but you didn't.
Yeah, that's a really good distinction.
Now leave the Met. So abstract expressionism emerges pretty much in the ashes of World War II. And I think it's easy when we think about history to think about World War II as like boosting America into this era of incredible economic prosperity. So it seems like a good time. But weirdly enough, people were really depressed afterwards.
That's weird. You mean you go and see
people died?
Right. You go see your best friends and siblings die. You're not going to come home and be happy.
Yeah, and then you find out about this mass genocide that happened, and you've got more access to it than you ever have before because we have television now.
Yeah.
Wild
Life
how
was
people
easy,
weren't.
Right?
Not everyone wanted to go to the sock hop, as it turns out.
Not for a
But refrigerators lasted 50 years. Let's not forget that.
<It's> Microwaves true. Did too, actually.
Yep.
When they were first made.
Back in my day. Now get off my
dad. My dad has a wood paneled microwave from like before I was born. Well, before I was born. And
that
it still runs.
That's oh my God. Are you legally allowed to use it outside of a basement?
Well, he lives on a second floor apartment and no one ever told us anything. So okay.
How's this third
I,
arm
I literally
doing?
Had to buy a new microwave that I like the one that I bought the day I graduated from college because I moved into an apartment. I had to like get a bunch of stuff. Already broke. That was 5 years ago.
That's
Not
true.
Even at the time. It was like a month
Gotta
short of 5
those
years.
Wood panels. Yeah.
I should have put new wood panels on it. You're right.
Right. Gotta get some more wainscoting.
Probably shouldn't have just left it in the trunk of my car this whole time.
I'll take a look at it after. Yeah.
I don't. What so I was getting at is that not everyone was having a great time in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And we'd also sort of started this in the late 19th century, but we developed a lot of ideas about psychology and we developed psychiatry. Freud was kind of like, here, take these drugs. You're probably romantically attracted to your mom.
Exactly.
And we determined that that wasn't right by that point. He did have a buddy, though, named Carl Jung, who, in my opinion, was far more interesting. He sort of developed this idea called collective human unconscious, which is this idea that across cultures you can find archetypes, mothers, fathers, death, life, and how they sort of have common symbology.
or war.
There's no real way to prove any of this, but he developed this idea that we almost have like a collective human memory, and that there are things that you can do sort of outside of language and recognizable
images. Visible
imagery.
Sorry, I remembered it differently in our collective memory.
Yeah. Well, you guys already know what I'm going to say if this is true, so.
Right.
He had this idea that we have sort of a collective human memory that you can tap into with things that just aren't language. Mm-hmm. Abstract expressionists did a lot of things, but one in particular adapted this idea onto the canvas. His name is Mark Rothko. He was a Russian Jewish immigrant who moved to Portland in the 1920s. By the 1940s, he had started painting what he's most famous for, which are giant paintings of hazy, colorful rectangles.
Yeah.
I know everyone's going to look this up on their phone, and that's great, and I'm really excited that you're going to look at Rothko, but I have to encourage all of you to find the nearest museum of the Rothko and go sit in front of one. Rothko's paintings look just like color on the surface, and they are, because it's a canvas covered in color. But what he really was trying to emote was an experience and a feeling and a reaction that was outside of the limitations of language and recognizable objects. He didn't want to paint what people had painted up until that point, because all of those things were marked by culture and by time period. So when you look at a painting from the 19th century, you're not going to have the same reaction in the 1950s, because you're looking at it and you're like, oh, that corset looks like it was painful.
Yeah.
But in his own words, Rothko said, he's not an abstractionist. I'm not interested in the relationship of color or form or anything else, which I'm going to cut in here as a common misconception about his work. I'm interested in expressing basic human emotions, tragedy, ecstasy, doom, and so on. His idea was that he could use color as a sort of meta language to elicit common experiences across cultural and situational borders. And I think that if you actually do go sit in front of a Rothko in a museum, you get it. It really does. There are these massive paintings, and if you just stare at the colors, the way that he layered the colors next to each other, they do seem to kind of undulate and glow. And as you look at it, I think you really do start to have like an emotional reaction. It might be different across people, and some people don't have any reaction, but to say that it's not about anything, or that it's just about color, or that they were painting nothing, it's like a super reduction of the idea. And actually, I found this quote while I was researching it. That's exactly what I wanted to say about it, which is that it's not painting about nothing. It's painting about everything.
Now I want to go find one. Now I don't know how to find these. I have a dumb question, and I don't even know if we'll have an answer to it. But whenever, like, I remember going to see abstract expressionism in a museum, like a long time ago when I was very young. And my initial thought was, that's just colors. But then my second thought was, how does someone like this get so famous on just doing, like, not to boil it down to nothing, but like color block? Like, do they have to build up a reputation, or do they build a whole career off of these? Or
I don't know if it's possible today is the difference too, right?
That's like, true, yeah.
Yeah. Do you guys want me to get a little historical again?
Of course, that's why you're here, right?
Yeah.
Okay, 1917, Marcel Duchamp, he's a Dadaist. If you don't know what Dadaism, look it up, it's great. It's basically art despite art, is how they described it.
Yeah, look at Dada.
Come on.
Exactly. We're going to talk about Mona Lisa again. Marcel Duchamp's, one of his most famous pieces of art is he did this idea called ready-mades, where he would take objects that already existed and submit them to juried art exhibitions. His most famous one is The Fountain. He signed it as Arma, and it is a urinal. And
oh,
he sent it in to this prestigious art show and was like, yeah, I made this. I signed it, and therefore it's mine.
So
art,
he's just
in spite
like
of art.
An art troll?
That's a perfect way to put it. They basically got really sick of all the people who were talking about how Mona Lisa was the greatest painting of all time.
Yeah.
Wow.
He actually straight up fired at the Mona Lisa. He bought a postcard of the Mona Lisa and painted a goatee on it.
I'm looking at that too.
So if you look at it in English, it's L-H-O-O-Q, and it looks like the word look. But in French, if you say those letters out loud, it's L-H-O-O-Q, which kind of sounds like, you know how there's that Britney Spears song, If You Seek Amy?
Nope.
Oh,
yeah,
never
course.
Mind. Yeah. Well, it means something else. And L-H-H-O-Q in French, if you say it out loud, sounds like she's got a hot donk.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, he was kind of irreverent. And after Dadaism, that kind of coalesces with Cubism, which was this idea that we were going to take multiple perspectives of the same object and then flatten it onto the surface of the two-dimensional canvas. You would know Picasso. He's also garbage. You should look up Braque.
Oh, man.
He's everyone's favorite.
All kinds of shade, and I love it.
Yeah, and I don't like Picasso either.
Yeah.
He said horrible things about women.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then after that, you start to get abstraction in general in art. Matisse was really cool. He painted figural stuff, but he really played with color. He was a, if I recall correctly, he was a fauvist, the wild beast. That's what they called him in France, because he was just so crazy with his colors.
I was going to say, that sounds sexy.
Around this time that Duchamp submits this urinal...
Do you know how you say the wild beast in French, actually? A gif a god bloom.
Gif god bloom? Come on.
That's, I'm just letting you guys know. I haven't participated in a minute.
Thank you for interjecting.
Point being, people started seeing art as conceptual rather than being for a purpose. Like, back in the 19th century, you'd be like, ah, cool, I'm going to pay this artist a lot of money to paint my wife. Mm-hmm. Sweet. And if he paints her as a naked and as Venus, even better, you know. Yeah. Can I say spank bait on Stranger Still?
Of course.
Okay, good. Spank bait.
Is that the intro? Or are we just going to put that instead?
Can I say
just that clip?
We'll see. We'll see.
But we started to talk about art as being something that you would pay for and that you would insure and that you could invest your money in. So essentially, if you wanted to be an artist, you would maybe do something that was a little bit brash. Or maybe you'd latch on to a movement that's a little bit brash. Like maybe you'd say, oh, it's really cool how Clifford Still just paints colors on all of his canvases. I bet I could do the same thing. And even though I'm going to imbue this with my own sort of ideological meaning, you're still trying to sell paintings. You're still trying to get people to want to use your paintings as an investment the same way they would use real estate. So paintings started to be worth money. And if you could sell a painting or you could do something that would make it worth money, you could become a famous painter. And that's pretty much how it went.
Yeah.
You'd also, you know, you'd submit them to juried art exhibitions, which you can still do today. That's how people gain notoriety today. And if you can do something really offensive or outgoing or that flies in the face of everything that happened before it, you can get pretty famous. And, you know, then you could be like Picasso, whose paintings are valued. They're some of the highest valued paintings in the world.
Yeah.
Mona Lisa actually holds the Guinness Book of World Records. Yeah, holds the Guinness World Record for highest valuation. It was valued at about $100 million in 1962 and adjusted for inflation. That's $650 million in 2018 for a 20-inch canvas of a lady who we don't even really know who she is and doesn't have eyebrows.
That's Jeff Bezos' weekend money.
Yeah, he makes that when he sneezes.
We had to talk about him.
We're talking about trash, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. We're talking about garbage. Well, we were talking about Rothko. He's not garbage at all.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to go on Amazon Prime and order some art.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me prime some Rothko prints.
Right. Yeah.
He'd love that.
It's like, what, 8 feet by 8 feet by the looks of these images?
Oh, one that looks like a Pokeball.
They're huge.
Yeah.
He actually... Rothko has a chapel that's in Houston, and it's like, I want to visit it so badly. I've just never really had a reason to go to Texas, but he has this
Make
incredible
pilgrimage.
Like octagonal room where he put up all these huge canvases.
Yeah.
Did you find one that looked like a Pokeball?
I found.
I found a Pokeball Rothko. It's red, black, and white.
So I'm looking at some of these Rothkos, and I mean, they are definitely gloom. Are you sure these weren't made in the Dark Ages?
Wow.
You see what I did there?
Yeah, we've already talked about the lower ages and the top ages.
Trying to talk about
is there
the
any other ages.
Ages
we didn't discuss?
What about all the ages in the middle, guys?
What's that, Elle?
I'm just saying, like, everyone talks about the Dark Ages like they were really bad, but they weren't that evil. They were, like, medieval at best. That is the joke of my career. I'm done.
That is perfect.
Goodbye. I have to go walk into the ocean now.
Yeah, we can end the podcast. No more episodes.
This one's pretty simple, guys. I studied medieval art. It was my specialty. People call it the Dark Ages because this guy, Petrarch, in 1330 thought he was living at the height of human civilization. Ho, 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 boy. Sorry.
I was going to say, he looks like a dork.
He is a dork.
Everyone go look this up. P-E-T-R-A-R-C-H. He is just the goofiest looking hedgehog I've ever seen.
You can remember it because Petrarch sounds like something you'd call a dad narc.
That's me.
He was a 1330s philosopher, and at one point he wrote about the Middle Ages. Amidst the errors, there shone forth men of genius. No less keen were their eyes, although they were surrounded by darkness and dense gloom. What he was talking about was this idea that we started to develop in the early Renaissance, when, again, people died of syphilis, but we thought we were living at the height of human civilization.
He hadn't heard of an iPhone yet, huh? Because those are pretty great.
Probably not. He didn't have a... Well, maybe it was before they had the... you had to download that app to get the flash to work as a flashlight.
Oh, man. I
truly the Dark
those
Ages.
Were truly the Dark Ages.
That's actually the Dark Ages. People use the Dark Ages to refer to the time between when the Roman Empire fell and the Renaissance began. Mm-hmm. Most people call that the Middle Ages now, and the idea of calling them the Dark Ages, that refers to the fact that we weren't really great at keeping centralized records, because in the Middle Ages, the Roman Empire fell, and you can argue when that happened. Some people say it's 330, some people say it's like the 600s. Either way, the church took control of pretty much everything. It was really, really tied in with like the monarchy at the time, and we didn't really have centralized record keeping. Art kind of changed. It didn't really fall by the wayside. It was just in service of a different god, actually.
So it went from, what, many gods, polytheism, to the ancient god, right?
Yeah, well, in ancient Rome, you know, you could just commission a copy of a Greek statue and slap your head on it and be like, oh, cool, I'm the discus thrower now. We didn't do that in the Middle Ages. Things just got decentralized, and for a long time in the Renaissance, you know, they'd started to paint things photorealistically. They'd started to use perspective. They kind of looked back at what had been made in the Middle Ages and saw it as lesser than, and I guess in some ways, in I guess a technical way, you could see it as that. But to call them the Dark Ages and say that they are void of any artistic merit is, like, such a ridiculous statement. Not even just because you don't know, but because, like, what happened a few weeks ago at Notre Dame?
Oh, yeah.
It burned. It and you know how burn. Upset everybody was?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's weird. I guess nothing good was made in the Middle Ages except for Notre Dame Cathedral.
So what are some other, like, key points of Middle Age art?
Well, we all seem to really love cathedrals, and sure. Most of them were built in the Middle Ages. We developed the pointed arch in 1141. Yeah, 1141, Abbot Suger, Saint-Denis, northern Paris. It's pretty great there. I've been there. It's amazing. We started making stained glass and using that as sort of the main motif that you would use to decorate your cathedrals, and everybody still likes to visit these things. And then in the 19th century, someone was like, hey, this medieval artwork is actually super cool. We should recreate it, but we're still going to talk about the Middle Ages like they sucked.
Yeah.
So cathedrals in general, Notre Dame's the famous one. Saint-Denis is really good. Cologne Cathedral's pretty amazing. Well, and then, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think it's interesting, now that you say that, like, stained art was around, looking at a lot of, like, the, stained glass, a lot of these paintings on canvas look like stained glass.
Yeah, Windex wasn't invented until many years later.
A couple decades.
Yeah. A few centuries, maybe.
So there was that. There's amazing illuminated manuscripts that were created. The Book of Kells is like one of the most amazing pieces of artwork that lots of people go and visit, and that's 9th century. There's a lot of tapestries that were created. The Lady and the Unicorn, that's one of the most visited things in France. And then, like you said, some of the painting was kind of interesting. I mean, it is the most memeable period of art.
Yeah. What was that webcomic that took like medieval art and then turned
it was the Bayeux Tapestry, and they put new captions on it. There's this amazing thing called the Bayeux Tapestry, and it's a linear visual account of William the Conqueror taking England.
Okay.
And Harold Godwin, who'd been king of England up until 1066, there's this incredible like image of him getting a spear straight through the eye. And when I learned about it in high school, we called it Harry Takes It in the Eye. Which is how I talk about that now.
There's no going back from that.
Yeah, Harry Takes It in the Eye.
I would Google that, but I don't want to know what comes up when I do that.
No, don't. But it's also kind of Eurocentric to say that it's the Dark Ages. There was art being made elsewhere in the world. Africa, Northern Africa, the Middle East, and actually, this is another thing nobody talks about, Spain, because Spain was an Islamic country for 800 years in the Middle Ages. Yeah. We're all producing pretty incredible art, creating mosques that are still iconic today. They were creating illuminated manuscripts and developing calligraphy that continues to be used, calligraphic styles. They built monuments that we continue to look at. A lot of what's in Israel, particularly in Jerusalem, was built during this period. And elsewhere in India, like my favorite example is the Chola bronzes, which are these really beautiful small bronze Indian statues made of like various gods were created. They're considered some of the most amazing bronze work in the world. And you can see a lot of them at the Metropolitan Museum of Art if you happen to be around New York. But there's also a lot of them in a lot of different places. There were a lot of these made. So it's Eurocentric and it simplifies a far more complicated time.
Wow.
So yeah, Middle Ages, not the Dark Ages. They were just different ages.
Thank you for shining some light on it.
Mm.
You see what I did there?
Tasty.
Would you say I illuminated it?
Yeah, you illuminated these manuscripts.
Like the manuscripts?
There's this, I've been frantically searching for this, it's Renaissance age art, and it's just people looking like brutally sad. It's like all this Gothic art, and it's got Little Caesar's quotes over it.
Oh, yeah, you showed me this.
Yes, no, you have to send this to me.
I'm going to look for it.
Is it a Twitter, like a Tumblr or Twitter account?
It's like Gothic
something?
Little Caesars, I think.
Tumblr has made some amazing stuff. Like, they're the ones who pointed out that everyone in early Renaissance art looks so shady and suspicious of literally everyone.
Yeah.
And there used to be a Tumblr dedicated to horrible depictions of the Christ child.
Like what?
Like one was like they took this like it's like a painting of like Mary holding baby Jesus and he's just ripped. And it's like the caption was like when you've been hitting the gym in the womb because of Beezus in 2 months. Or there was one where it just did not look like a human yet and it was like, I think you got to put that Christ cake back in the oven for a few minutes, Mary.
Oh god.
You got to find these
I found Gothic Little Caesars.
Yeah, I was about to say.
It's gothic-little-caesars.tumblr.com.
We're gonna have to have an accompanying like a Facebook group post with all of these things.
Oh
in
yeah,
it.
Absolutely. I want to find that baby Jesus thing. What was it called again?
I don't even remember. I probably still follow it on Tumblr. I haven't ever cleared out my Tumblr. Little Caesar's Gothic paintings. Can I be really, really pedantic about this Tumblr?
Yes, please.
None of these are Gothic paintings.
What are
Gothic
they?
Gothic is a time period. These are probably all romanticism at best.
Wonderful.
That's
Unless
when
we got you here for
it. Now you've ruined that's, John's life.
That's when everyone in Europe just... Can I say... It's really hard to be PG rated.
I know. Just use poetic language and we won't censor it.
Everyone was really, really, really aroused for the Middle Ages again.
I think we've said Randy on the show before.
Well, the middle is the most attractive part of the human body.
That's true. That's what I've heard.
Yeah, everyone's real into belly buttons, right? The dead center.
I used to eat from there. All right.
The belly button?
Yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying. He's talking about the placenta is what he's saying because he's really funny. Trust me.
Is that the placenta?
The umbilical cord and placenta.
Yeah.
No, it's not the placenta. My wife's going to yell at me. There. It's definitely the umbilical cord. But anyway.
That's all I got.
Does everyone out there feel like an art scholar now? I feel like I just took a lecture in art history in college, which is
yeah.
The best
can you give us some fancy words to walk away with to impress everyone?
Yeah. What's the best art terminology that I can use to make someone
feel worse about themselves?
Feel worse about themselves.
Yeah.
Well, walk up to paintings and say things like, "I love the painterly strokes here," but make sure they're actually painterly strokes.
That's a good, good distinction.
Talk about the naturalistic representation.
Okay, I like this. I'm writing this down. Type, type, type. I'm typing this.
Throw the word semiotics around because I studied it for 2 years and still couldn't really tell you what it means, but I did use it in a lot of papers.
Perfect. I like that.
Can we say that slower?
Semiotics.
Semiotics.
Sem, like with an M.
The
like
semiotics
man.
Weapons.
Oh,
we're trying to get those banned. So.
Right.
Yeah, we're banning semiotics.
Awesome. Well, thank you for this tour through art history.
Yes, Nicholas. It's wonderful. This was a... John, I'm sorry. Are you not keeping up with my semiotics?
I looked down for a second... Mm-hmm. And I looked back up and John was swirling a glass of wine and had a very well-groomed mustache.
Mm.
And he's got a pressed velvet...
He's wearing a stock collar and a cravat and a pressed velvet doublet. And he's talking about Foucault.
Yeah.
I'm talking about how the painterly brushstrokes are very brushed.
Well... I don't know about you guys, but I could use a quick little break, and I would appreciate it if you go and shave that mustache, John.
I'll think about it.
And we'll be right back.
Yeah.
All right, James and Mary and John and Patricia and Jennifer and Robert and Michael and Linda, I see you out there listening to this podcast. And you know what you're not doing right now? You're not leaving a review for us on iTunes, which is what you should do right now. Pull out your phone and just leave us a quick little review. And it's the nicest thing you can do for us.
One of the nicest things that you could do for us, yeah.
I think, yeah, the nicest thing you could do would be to
tell a friend, share it, buy us things.
Even nicer than that, dude. I think that they could go to
my house.
Patreon.com.
Okay.
They could go to patreon.com/flyingmachine. And if they just kick a few bucks our way, they get all kinds of wonderful stuff. Like what, John?
Like bonus content and episodes, extra talking, swearing, yeah, and fun.
We do swear on our bonus episodes. You get bonus episodes for every show on the network, like Short, Colorful, and Loud, or Falling in Love Montage, or The Losers, or Divisive Issues, or the Pot Stirrer Podcast. I think that's all of them. And you also get exclusive shows to the Patreon, which are the MC Universe, which is Malcolm and Justin talking about the MCU, which
University.
also famously threw shade at, not but like half an hour ago.
Mm-hmm.
There might be some other shows coming to the Patreon. You'll just have to...
You said that slow enough to cause suspicion, Nicholas.
Well, I don't think I am supposed to talk about it yet.
Okay.
But just stay tuned.
I'm gonna raise my voice in equal suspicion.
It might star L. I'll just say that. It might have L in it. So
it might.
It's going to come out.
So,
who,
yeah,
knows? Just... We're all going to talk real high pitch now, right?
Yeah.
Right. If you guys start real high and then go down low at the end.
Yes.
I'm just saying that if someone subscribes and mentions or becomes a patron and mentions that they did it because of this episode, mm-hmm, John and I will do an entire podcast in high voices just like this, just for you.
Hi.
And dogs around the neighborhood will start going, rawr, 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 rawr.
Yeah.
It'll actually just be a 40-minute barking track of John's house.
That's, yeah, true. You can just do that. But yeah, for like $1, you get live streams, you get exclusive blog entries, you get all kinds of stuff. You get, for $5, you get those bonus episodes, you get newsletters, and then we're gonna have a brand new tier for $10. You'll just have to check it out and see what it is. Mm-hmm. Just go to patreon.com/flyingmachine and educate yourself. That's all I got. Hey, John, I meant L. Hey, L. If people wanted to know more about your podcast, what could they do to do that? That was the worst sentence I've ever said, but answered anyway.
We did
anyway.
Name this episode 5 pieces of art that aren't what you think they are. So, you know, it's top 5.
Yeah, it's a good day for that.
So, like I said, I'm from Short, Colorful, and Loud. It's not that short of a podcast, though.
false advertising. Yeah. Leaving that in a review.
It's loud. I mean, you get up to 0 dBs here and there.
It is.
Zach
loud.
Is very colorful.
We're all a little colorful.
Yeah.
So you can find it at the flyingmachine.network website. You could also find it wherever you get podcasts. And if you really wanted to, you could go to shortcolorfulandloud.tumblr.com, which is where we post our episodes. Find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. Just type Short, Colorful, and Loud and we'll come up.
Yeah. One thing that I often forget to ask people is what would be a good starting point for people if you're like, this is our quintessential episode to get people hooked? What would you tell them to listen to?
We did I've got two. We did Quest for Camelot, which is a 1998 film created by Turner Animation. It's awesome. It's like exactly what we like to talk about. And we also did an episode on Ice Age, which is a really famous movie, but maybe you forgot all the cool stuff about it. We talk about death a lot in that episode, but it's great.
Yeah. I will say the Quest for Camelot episode, never heard of that movie, but after listening to you guys talk about it, I was like, this sounds wild and I really want to watch it.
You should.
So I almost paused the episode to go listen to it because I was like, this is just bonkers.
There's a lot in there that'll make you feel super nostalgic too. That's just like a lot of the 2D Disney stuff that you go into.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or non-Disney. You got Ferngully, Gallivants.
Yeah. Like Ferngully is like my wife's favorite movie from her childhood. She always talks about Ferngully.
It held up, which is not always the case with movies.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. So yeah, if you're feeling nostalgic, you want to listen to two goofballs, if I may call you a goofball, talk about children's movies, go check out Short, Colorful, and Loud. I think you'll enjoy it.
And leave them a damn review too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
That'd be cool.
Linda and Joseph.
And Barbara, and the fifth Barbara. Most popular U.S. name.
Leave me a review, James.
Yeah.
Yeah, James and
what
John.
What are you doing? Or Jim, if you want to go by Jim.
Or Jim, yeah, right. Jim works
or,
too. Yeah.
Or Jamie.
Yeah.
Or
Jamie Cakes. Everyone's Jamie favorite Cakes, nickname
that's
for James.
That's in the top 100.
This is my son, Jimmy Cakes Jeffrey. Anyway.
He goes by James Jamethy for long. You guys don't have a long name?
No, we... When I did a webcomic with my friend Jacob, we had this character whose legal name was Bart, but he went by Bartholomew for short.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. So you have a Nick. Nick is your nickname, but yeah. You have your Nicholas name.
Yeah.
Is your long version. So my name's like Jonathan.
Yeah.
And
that's like the quintessential dad joke. Like, Nick is my nickname, but Nicholas is my Nicholas name.
Yeah.
I think all three of us have a long name. We all have a short name and a long name.
Yeah.
Yeah. Elithy.
Yeah.
Elithy.
Jonathan.
John and Jonathan.
Right. Elithy is my name. That's what my parents named me.
On the birth certificate, right next to your art degree.
Yeah. Yeah.
I moved that around from room to room too. People also ask me what I'm doing with my birth certificate at family gatherings. It's weird.
Yeah, that's oddly specific.
Birth certificate. No, they want to know where my social security card is because it says Elithy, which is kind of strange.
Yeah, people ask me that all the time online.
I get a lot of emails.
Yeah, got a lot of Saudi princes to help.
They just want to know how you're decorating your home with your social security card.
Yeah, it's for reasons. Quit asking. We went off the rails. Yeah. Do you guys have anything else on art or otherwise? I'll take that.
I vote yes. I say yes to art.
You are in favor of art?
Yeah, I think all art is overall. I give it a positive review.
Yeah. What about you, L?
An A for art.
Are you in favor of art?
Yes. Categorically cool. So. I paid a lot of money to be able to say that and make an informed decision.
Yeah.
You're legally in favor of art.
Yeah. The federal government paid a lot of money for me to go make an informed decision about that.
Okay. This is good.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, L. Make sure everyone out there, you check out Short, Colorful, and Loud. And
thank you guys for having me.
Of course. It was awesome. I love talking about things that people are passionate about. So join us next week. We'll have another exciting guest on. And go to patreon.com/flyingmachine. Until then, I'm still Nick.
I'm still John.
But are you?
We've never gotten that one before.
Oh, wow. Goodness.
Well, that's, you know, we live in post-modernism, so, like, really, who are you?
How can you even know? If I tell you that I'm still Nick, how do you know that I'm Nick?
Yeah, and
what
I'm
does
still John.
Nick mean?
It means...
You know when you chop down a tree and you're like, oh, I gosh dang Nicholas'd it. Mm-hmm. Well, people got tired of saying that, so they shortened it to Nick.
Yeah.
Because you, like, get a nick in the tree when you're chopping it down to make your cabin. I'm still John.
I'm still Nick.
Am I supposed to say I'm still L?
Yeah.
And this is Stranger Still.
I give you the incredible flying machine.